February 26, 2007. We're going to open up the work session on House Bill 2185. Representative Maurer?
Yes, Madam Chair, I move House Bill 2185 to the floor without recommendation as the passage in the bill referred to the Emergency Preparedness and Ocean Policy Committee by prior reference.
Representative Maurer moves House Bill 2185 to the floor without recommendation as to passage, and the bill is to be referred to the Emergency Preparedness and Ocean Policy Committee by prior reference. Any discussion? Any objection? We don't need to vote on this, do we? Do we?
Do need to vote.
Okay. Susan, will you call the roll, please?
Representative Cowan?
Aye.
Representative Belzer?
Aye.
Representative Gilliam?
Aye.
Excused.
Aye.
Representative Maurer?
Aye.
Representative Olson?
Aye.
Representative May?
Aye.
Madam Chair?
Yes.
Just a question on this one.
Yes.
Well, after it's heard by, just process, after it's heard by the other committee, will it then come back to us also?
No,
on this
it
one?
Won't.
Not at all?
No.
Okay.
Any other discussion? All right. House Bill 2185 will go to the floor without recommendation, and it will be referred to the Emergency Preparedness and Ocean Policy Committee by prior reference. So we close the public hearing on 2185, and we open up an informational meeting. Okay. Do you want to say anything?
I think they can introduce
you. Okay. Would County Commissioner Janet Carlson and County Commissioner Lisa Nato come up to the speaker?
We're going to bring up Raul Ramirez.
They're bringing a bodyguard up here.
Really?
The chair.
They know you are bodyguards.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Janet Carlson, Marion County Commissioner. Very appreciative of the opportunity to meet with you today to talk about a very important topic to counties and to the state of Oregon. As you are well aware, the legislature took an important step last session around methamphetamine. It is a major issue in our communities, and you were able to pass a bill that put pseudoephedrine behind the counter, that added some sanctions and added some resources to drug courts. We believe it's now time for step two, and step two is around putting the families back together and dealing with the individuals that are trying to put their lives back together. In order to accomplish this, we need to have resources in our communities for treatment for alcohol and drug abuse and a number of other important programs. You should have being passed out right now. This is an overview of our day today and the speakers that you will hear. We also have some research briefs for you to look at at your leisure. And this paper here, which the executive summary is on the top, so don't get too overwhelmed by the size of it underneath. We took about a year as the Association of Oregon County's Human Services Steering Committee to come up with a comprehensive agenda for Oregon around methamphetamine prevention, intervention, and treatment. And treatment is a core piece of what we are hoping to be able to get through the legislature this session. So with that, I am going to turn it over to Lisa Nato, Commissioner from Multnomah County.
Thank you, Lisa Nato from Multnomah County, Chair Tomei and honorable members of the legislature. I come to you as the chair of the Public Safety Committee of the Association of Oregon Counties, and we've teamed up together because this is an issue that involves both public safety and human resources. You're going to hear this morning from the experts, and I won't presume to tell you what they're going to say, but the real message that I've heard as a county commissioner and as a former legislator is that treatment works. It's effective. We know it is a best practice, and of course it has to be monitored, it has to be a certain protocols, but it makes a difference in people's lives. We prevent victims from that, and it's much more cost effective than jail. So from an intellectual standpoint, just that we know the evidence shows that it works and that it's effective. That's a message that really hasn't got out completely to the public, but the research is pretty clear on that, and I think you'll hear that this morning. From a perspective of your heart, though, is another reason, and we don't have the people here, but I've met the people, as many of you have, who have been addicts. A woman who reached rock bottom in prison, lost her family, her work, and was addicted to methamphetamines, and yet turned her life around, got treatment in prison, and came out and is productive and now a speaker. I've met people who've lost their jobs, and people who've come from all walks of life. This is something that doesn't affect just people who are poor or uneducated. It affects everybody, people who drive under the influence of alcohol and so forth. So treatment works, and we know there's also people who need it and people who are waiting right now for treatment. We have 400 people in Multnomah County on a waiting list for treatment. And so the need is also really clear, and the need for additional resources. I know you have a lot of challenges in terms of resources and things that you're going to do this session. I know you'll step up for children and all sorts of important topics, and this is another one of them. So I'd like to introduce next, to talk a little bit more about public safety, is Sheriff Ramirez from Marion County. He was named the Sheriff of the Year, and I think that speaks about my esteem for him. And he's also president of the Sheriff's Association. So it's with great honor that I introduce him.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, thank you for allowing us this morning to come and share with you a perspective of the challenges that we face as a state around drug and alcohol substance abuse.
Sheriff, could you please announce yourself for the record?
I will. Raul Ramirez, Marion County Sheriff and President of the Oregon State Sheriff's Association.
Thank you.
Your jail facilities, and I use that description because it's about citizens that unfortunately end up in the criminal justice system. Some that are able to deal with their own issues, others that cannot. And methamphetamine and alcohol are significant drivers of not only the impact in our communities, but also the impact in our jail facilities, your jail facilities. When we look at the vast number of individuals that are involved in the system that have substance abuse issues, both drug and alcohol, in your local jail, it runs about 85 to 90% of the jail population, 85 to 90%, and we're being conservative. On top of that, you have to look at the number of individuals that are brought in on a yearly basis to your local jail, and that number is 190,000 arrests, bookings, that are brought into your local jails. Now, you take that figure, take 85, 90% of that population when we look at substance abuse and then the issue of mental illness. We recognize that treatment does work. And again, when we look at evidence-based practices, which is now a theme that resonates, and it's a belief and a commitment that we have in public safety is wrapped around evidence-based, that resonates across the state. But the challenge is, how do we meet those needs? There certainly is an issue of resources, particularly at the local level, when you think about rural counties that might not have residential treatment services. They struggle in meeting those needs of offenders in custody. So the challenge is, how do we support local communities? And I understand the commitment at the state level, but there still is a disconnect in resource and service delivery between at the state DOC, Department of Corrections, when we think about those in custody, and your local jail facilities, 190,000 coming through those facilities. These are Oregonians that are falling through the cracks, struggling. What I've handed out to you is an overview of resources that are provided here in Marion County. When you think about the number of offenders that we manage in the county, 20,000 bookings is what we deal with here in Marion County. As you can see, some of the numbers that I provided to you are...
Jeff, could you please let us know which materials you're referring to?
Yeah.
Thank you.
And again, this just gives you a snapshot of the services that we provide in Marion County, which is minimal compared to the number of offenders in the system locally here. Intervention needs, to wrap up here, we need to continue to expand treatment programs for offenders. It's clear, both in custody as well as residential and outpatient treatment. When we think about treatment, you also need to consider what are the social drivers that brought this individual to the criminal justice system. We can say, well, you know, they became addicted, whether it's alcohol or drugs, meth, and other substance abuse issues. But when we look at an individual's issues, those social drivers that have a negative impact on the individual are employment, education, housing, and of course the treatment issue, mental illness, and parenting skills. A lot of the individuals that are in the criminal justice system are parents. And we do have some effective programs out there to break that, what we describe as the intergenerational cycle, where we provide those life skills to parents in custody that want to participate. And again, treatment is part of that. But without wraparound services to these individuals beyond treatment, without providing that type of support as they transition back into the community, they're going to be destined to fail. If there is no opportunities for employment, they lack the skills. We recently conducted a survey at the Marion County Jail, which profiled our inmate offenders. 66% of inmates, and I can provide you with a copy of that survey, but it looked at the social drivers of our population. 66% of our inmates don't even have a high school diploma. So what's the expectancy of these individuals to sustain themselves once they're released from custody? Then you look at the issue of struggling with their substance abuse, but if they can't support themselves, employment is another major issue. And even if they're employed before they came into custody, 65% of them did not have any type of medical benefits. So if you're a parent, you can see the struggle that they're having, not only to sustain themselves, but also their family. That's just a quick snapshot of the issues that we're grappling with at the local level. So please consider resources, efforts to provide treatment at the local level, as well as the state level, as you look at these issues that we grapple with and the challenges that we're faced with at the local level. Thank you.
Thank you, Sheriff. Any questions for
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you for your testimony, all of you. Could you comment a little bit on how drug courts are working in Marion County?
The recidivism that we're experiencing, reduction of recidivism, is somewhere around 50% or higher, depending on the individual. But again, it's an effective program, but it only reaches a small number of the population. It is an effective program, and if our effort here is to reduce recidivism and get individuals on the right track and get them out of the system, drug court does work. But we need to broaden that support system for these offenders, these individuals that are struggling with substance abuse.
Could I just add briefly, too, we have a juvenile drug court called Star Court in Marion County, an adult drug court, and we also have a new drug court called Fostering Attachment, where Judge Pamela Abernathy is actually working with pregnant parenting moms, and the goal is to have a drug-free baby that's born and to keep that mom off of drugs. It deals more with the dependency issues, and I believe that those have been very successful.
Thank you. Thank you. Any further questions? Right. Thank you very
Thank
much.
You.
Okay, Paul McCarty, Eric Martin, and Anthony Biglan. Dennis McCarty. While we're waiting, I just Representative Olson just showed me the paper from yesterday, or Saturday.
Oh, it's yesterday's paper.
Yeah. We had talked about gambling addiction last week and mental health issues. Both of them on the front page.
Okay, I'm ready. Madam Chair Tomei, members of the committee, I'm Dennis McCarty, and I'm a professor of public health and preventive medicine at Oregon Health and Science University. I work at the intersection of policy, practice, and research relative to the treatment for alcohol and drug disorders. drug and alcohol treatment programs are challenged with insufficient funding, or excuse me, unlimited demand, drug and alcohol treatment programs are challenged with limited resources, unlimited demand, and insufficient infrastructure. The programs that I work with have learned to translate those challenges into opportunities. And I'm going to talk a little bit about the opportunities they have and the opportunities specifically to improve the quality and the effectiveness of drug and alcohol treatment programs. I'm going to use a conversation I had on an airplane recently to help illustrate that, because I think it reflects many of the things that the general public believes about alcohol and drug treatment. I was in the middle seat, bulkhead row, Sunday evening, flying out of Atlanta to Washington, D.C. Mr. Everyman stepped in, sat down at the window seat, and as we took off from Atlanta, turned to me and said, "What do you do, sir?" I really didn't want to have a conversation, so I used a standard response. "I study the organization and financing of treatment for alcohol and drug disorders," and that's usually sufficient to inhibit continued conversation. In this case, he responded, he said, "I know exactly what to do." Curious, I said, "Oh, what's that?" And he said, "Well, treatment doesn't work. We all know that. We should just put them on an island." And he went on to explain that on an island, they won't hurt anybody else, they won't affect the rest of us, they can enjoy their drugs, and eventually they'll die off. Well, that turns out to be a relatively popular theory in some areas. And I had to think about and reflect, should I disengage, should I engage? I decided this was a teachable moment. So I took the time to begin talking. And some of the things I'll talk about are why do we need to improve, how to improve, and do improvements work. And I'll do that within the context of the conversation I had on the airplane. He began by saying treatment doesn't work. And the reality is treatment does work. 40 to 60% of the patients who enter care are abstinent at 12 months. Now, of course, that means the converse, that some are not abstinent. It means we can do better. We're not satisfied with that. But it also helps to have a comparison point. And the comparison point here is other chronic illnesses. Adherence is about 60% for type 1 diabetes, 40% adherence for asthma and hypertension. The reality is drug and alcohol treatment programs with far fewer resources are as effective as other forms of medical intervention for chronic problems. There are effective treatments. This is a list of therapies that Miller and Wilburn have examined. They've listed these as the most effective of therapies based on research. Treatment programs also are in an environment that's rapidly changing. There are demands for more accountability. The Institute of Medicine has a series of reports, generally called Crossing the Quality Chasm, which are challenging all of healthcare to provide care that's safe, effective, patient-centered, timely, effective, and equitable. And recently, the Substance Abuse and Mental Health Administration has done their own analysis of Crossing the Quality Chasm and said these principles also apply to drug and alcohol treatment program. These dimensions of quality care are going to become standards that all treatment programs in the United States are expected to document and to demonstrate and to achieve. And they're going to do that through reauthorization of the Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Administration and the Block Grant. And they're going to add requirements to participate in the National Outcome Monitoring System and to document your ability to meet those quality standards. And state initiatives are also changing the treatment environment. In Oregon, we have Senate Bill 267, which is an intriguing piece of legislation that we're looking at closely. In California, you have the Substance Abuse and Crime Prevention Act, which has really changed the texture of their treatment system. Those are some of the challenges, and in those challenges, there are opportunities. Treatment programs can improve and reduce their expenses. Treatment programs can improve and develop new markets and new services. They can implement these evidence-based practices, and they can build new alliances and new linkages with primary care. HIV, HCV are dominant problems in our patient population. Many of the patients have comorbid mental health problems, the criminal justice system we've already heard from this morning, and the child welfare system. So change is not easy. Change is challenging. It's not self-executing. They need purposeful activity and attention to organization and staff selection, staff training, supervision, coaching and feedback, administrative support and system interventions. And the important aspect of that is that without that infrastructure, efforts to improve are likely to fail.
Excuse me, could you please take out your cell phones and blackberries and blueberries and raspberries and look at them and then turn them off, not just on silence or what do you call it?
Vibrate.
Vibrate or whatever. Yeah, it's got to be completely off or else it affects the sound system for Susan who's trying to record this. Thank you. Sorry.
Thank you, Madam Chair. At Oregon Health and Science, we're involved in a national program called the Network for the Improvement of Addictions Treatment. And this program has five key principles. One, you begin with an understanding of who your customer is, your patient. Secondly, you address the big problems. Those are the ones that keep the CEO awake at night. And they're the ones that typically relate to the business sense, that these are affecting the viability of the organization. You need to find the people on your staff who can be powerful change leaders. You need to take ideas from other programs and from outside the field and use rapid cycle testing because we found that it helps them to change. And importantly, and I'll come back to this, NIATX 200 is going to be available for Oregon providers to participate in, and I think it can have a dramatic effect on the state's treatment system. In order to understand the customer, it's important to be a customer. And we're asking treatment programs to walk through their admission process, to pretend you're a client, to pretend you're a family member, to see what happens. And when programs do that, they call for an appointment, they find that they get into voicemail hell, they don't get a real person, they get put off for 2 or 3 weeks, they begin to understand how difficult it is for the patient to negotiate their program. And they begin to think about how to make changes. They try to address the problems that the CEO values. They appoint a change leader with the authority to make change. They use rapid cycle testing. And that means that you plan the change, you do the change, you study the results, and you act on the results, but you keep it simple. Let's try this for the next patient. Let's try this for the next week. That way it's not overwhelming. And in fact, Art Scott, who's the CEO at MECA, one of the treatment programs that we work with, says it reduces staff resistance to change. It engages staff at a low level. The change is temporary and begins small, so it's not overwhelming. And the staff begin to buy in and become part of the change. At Acadia Hospital in Maine, they wanted to improve their access to their intensive outpatient treatment program. They had a 4-day wait to get into the outpatient program, and as a result of that 4-day wait, only about 30% of the patients were actually showing up. They decided they were going to just come in next morning at 7:30, and we'll do the assessment, we'll get you into treatment by 9 o'clock, and they reduced that wait from 4 days to 1 day. They had more patients start treatment, and they had more patients complete treatment. And the result for Acadia was not only did they serve more people over a 4-year period, they served 4 times as many people, but over a 3-year period, they went from a $200,000 a year deficit to a $200,000 a year surplus in that service. They were able to remove barriers. Sicker patients came into care. They helped more patients. They helped the agency, and they helped the treatment providers in the agency. Nationally, this is what the data look like. This is the average reduction in days to treatment from almost 20 days down to about 12 days, and that was a significant improvement of nearly 40%. And more people stayed in care. 18% more people came back for a second session. 17% more people came back for a third session. And 10% more people came back for the fourth session. I'm going to return here to the conversation I had on the airplane because it ended in an unexpected fashion. We went back and forth on the airplane. We amused each other. I don't think we changed either of ours opinion. But as we landed at National Airport, Mr. Quiet Man here on the aisle turned to me and said, "Thank you for your conversation. I really enjoyed that." And he said, I've been in recovery for 12 years from heroin use myself. Now, it's unusual for people to disclose that in the field. I thanked him for his disclosure and said, congratulations, that's hard work. And he said, yes, yes it is, it's hard work. And then more to himself than to me, he said, many of my friends never made it. And ultimately, that's why we're challenged to improve our services. It's not Mr. Quiet Man on the aisle. He took advantage of the services he improved. It's his friends who never made it that we seek to improve our services for. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Any questions? Representative Maurer?
Yes, Madam Chair. I have a couple questions. On slide 3.
Swap out. Yes.
Where you use second bullet, comparable outcomes for chronic disease. Are you talking specifically about compliance? Is it comparable compliance? Is that another way of...
I think compliance is an important dimension. Compliance with medication, compliance with diet. I think compliance is a good word there.
Okay, so you're talking about type 1 diabetes, 60% of patients comply with their physicians.
With the diet, with, correct.
Okay, thank you.
Correct.
And then the other question I had, or actually these are two comments if I may.
Sure, certainly.
One is about your Acadia Hospital open access.
Mm-hmm.
I wish that other areas in medicine would follow that. And
yeah.
I think we probably would.
In fact, the more background on Niatex is that it actually comes out of other areas of medicine, and we're applying these principles for the first time to treatment for alcohol and drug disorders.
And then last was your term rapid cycling.
Mm-hmm.
A term I'm familiar with is rapid prototyping at an organizational level.
Right.
And again, I wish state government would use this more often because it is effective. And I think we could spend an hour talking about what that means, but
yeah.
I appreciate your comments.
Well, I thank you for your observations. Niatex has actually been extended to include state agencies. Their idea of RAPID is a little different than treatment program's idea of RAPID, but we're still proud, we're pleased that they're trying to take that on and to absorb those lessons as well.
Representative Gelser.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you for this presentation, and I apologize if this isn't the right place to direct this question. But in terms of outcomes and admissions and barriers to admissions, where do people that have addictions to prescription drugs fall into this? Is it difficult for them to get into treatment programs? Is it difficult for them to identify that they have a problem? And what is the medical community doing in terms of its responsibility in prescribing those drugs and helping patients to be able to get into treatment programs?
Those are excellent questions. I think in terms of difficulty of getting into treatment, it's no more difficult than it is for anyone else. Now, the reality is that only that about 1 in 6 people who need treatment actually access treatment. And there's a variety of reasons, variety of barriers, explanations for why they don't. For people who are dependent on prescription medications, the challenge is they don't think of themselves as a person who has a drug problem. Many of them are pain patients, chronic pain patients, are looking for ways to relieve their pain. We are involved currently at Oregon Health and Science University in a program called the National Drug Abuse Clinical Trials Network. And that network has just begun a study of treatment for prescription opiate dependence using a medication called Suboxone, which has recently been approved by the FDA for use by physicians throughout the country. ADAPT, which is a treatment program in Roseburg, Oregon, is participating in that study. We hope to find that it's an effective strategy to engage them into care, retain them into care, and to allow them to transition to other mechanisms for treating their pain.
Thank you.
Okay.
Any further questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you,
Madam Chair.
Appreciate
your coming to share your information with us. Would you like to let us know who you are?
Hi, I'm Eric Martin, and I'm director of the Addiction Counselor Certification Board of Oregon, and I'm an instructor with the University of Oregon and the State Child Welfare System, and I'm on the Governor's Advisory Board on Drugs and Violent Crime. I've been working in the treatment field for about the last 21 years, and I'm also a recovering addict myself. I was addicted to crack cocaine and went into treatment in 1983. So, I need to turn my computer on. My computer is on. That's not on yet. Can you toggle it, maybe? Okay. Do I have to put in the telephone?
We done the function F7?
Yes. We have.
Great. Thank you, Susan.
Okay.
Thank you.
Well, I was asked to speak a little bit about cognition and the effect that alcohol and drugs, specifically methamphetamine, have on cognition and how this presents challenges for treatment providers around the state. Before I start specifically on methamphetamine and cognition, I want to say that there is a growing body of research in regards to early onset substance abuse and the impact that early onset substance abuse has on the developing mind. We used to think that the mind was fully developed by the age of 13. We now know that the mind is still developing all the way up until the age of 24, that myelination is occurring in the frontal lobes of the brain and new connections are being formed. So there is this growing body of research to suggest that when kids start drinking or using drugs between the ages of 8 and 15 years old, that this can affect the developing mind. Currently, Oregon 8th graders drink 86% higher than the national average and use illegal drugs at a rate about twice the national average. Significant research now through SAMHSA, the Substance Abuse Mental Health Services Administration, really suggests to us that the most problematic substance abusers in our society are early onset substance abusers. 95% of U.S. adult alcoholics and alcohol abusers started drinking before the age of 21. They've done a significant amount of research looking at the effect of early onset substance abuse, looking at kids that don't drink at all, kids that drank in the past year but not in the past month, all the way up to heavy use. They found that heavy alcohol-using 12 to 17-year-olds are twice as likely to participate in violence than kids who don't drink. That they are four times as likely to seriously attack others than kids who don't drink. That they are 12 times more likely to steal than kids who don't drink. That they are 34 times more likely to sell drugs than kids who don't drink. That they are 5 times more likely to carry a handgun than kids who don't drink. In fact, research on more than 42,000 kids has shown that every year that drinking is postponed, all the way up until around the age of 22 or so, significantly reduces the statistical probability of somebody ever becoming an alcohol abuser or alcohol dependent. NIDA has done significant research on this now, and they found that kids with early onset substance abuse have up to 5 times higher rates of substance abuse and dependence when they track them into their 20s, and significantly higher rates of anxiety and depression. So we know that this is a piece of the puzzle when we look at brain cognition and people's ability to function in our society. Oregon ranks 7th nationally for recent illicit drug use in people 12 and older. We rank 2nd in the U.S. for illicit drug use among adults 26 and up, and 4th in the U.S. for drug abuse and dependence among 18 to 25-year-olds. Simultaneously, Oregon ranks 45th in the U.S. for treatment access, and we rank 49th in the U.S. for treatment access among 18 to 25-year-olds. And in response to a question that you posed, Vice Chair, Oregon now ranks 3rd in the U.S. for prescription, non-medical prescription drug abuse among 12 to 17-year-olds. So, speaking specifically to cognition, let's take a look at some of the effects that methamphetamine has on the brain. In NIDA's research, most of the damage that occurs in the brain is in the frontal lobes in the limbic section of the brain, and in the brain's hippocampus. The brain's hippocampus is largely responsible for attention and memory. The limbic section of the brain regulates emotion. Dr. Nora Volkov, executive director of NIDA, did a study of 22 methamphetamine addicts, and she tracked these 22 methamphetamine addicts over a period of 3 years, scanning their brains. She found an 8% tissue loss in this part of the brain right here, the hippocampus, an 11% tissue loss in this part of the brain right here, and that was over a period of 3 years. It's important to understand that most of the clients that we get into the addiction treatment system, into criminal justice, and co-occurring disorder clients in the mental health system are early onset substance abusers. The vast majority of them started drinking and using drugs at a very young age. This is quite different than most of the rest of the population. We see significant mental impairments in folks when they first come into treatment. In an analysis of 10 different studies that look specifically at methamphetamine and cognition, it's been noted that for about the first 3 months of treatment, that people have severe cognitive impairments in their ability to make inferences, to manipulate and synthesize information, to understand metaphor, to demonstrate insight, learn from experience, and ignore irrelevant information. People have difficulty in their capacity to function, and oftentimes we expect people to be grossly responsible upon the moment that they enter the criminal justice system. And we expect them to sort of do this 180, and it doesn't really work, that sort of tack with these particular folks. I was in one teaching a class on methamphetamine to a group of probation parole officers, and I suggested that that we should probably be calling all of these folks and reminding them about their court dates and reminding them about all of their probation parole appointments. And these POs just about fell out of their chair. And they were like, yeah, that's a good idea, Eric. Yeah, why don't we go over to their house and cook them dinner, too, and maybe give them a little foot massage? I was like, well, you know, the funny thing is that all of our doctors and dentists do it for us. They do it for us. They call us and remind us about all of our appointments, but we don't really have a good system to remind these folks about all of their appointments. And we know from research that they have severe cognitive and memory impairments. There's been 4 studies across the United States where they've simply called clients in treatment and reminded them about their appointments, and they've seen up to 70% increases in retention and completion rates, just calling and reminding people. Previously, people thought that they just weren't motivated. Well, they're just not motivated. They don't want to quit drinking or using drugs. They just want to stay out there and be addicted to drugs. A large part of these folks does want to quit. They simultaneously want to quit and want to use at the same time. Any of you that have ever smoked cigarettes or have known people that have smoked cigarettes, you know this is true, that people can want to quit and want to use at the same exact moment in time. And you've probably seen people do this, smoking cigarettes, and they're like, oh, I wish I could quit. Oh, I'd like to quit. And it's like, well, but you're smoking. You're smoking and wanting to quit at the same time. And we know that that's entirely possible, and that's the experience of many of these addicts. So treatment programs have to do a lot of work with folks in that first 90 days. And we anticipate that they're going to have severe cognitive impairments. Research also shows that memory gets worse. Memory gets worse. See, a lot of times within business as usual, we expect that people are going to be instantaneously better. And we give them a whole list of assignments to do. Okay, you need to, once you get out of jail, you need to go to all these parenting classes, you need to go to probation and parole, you need to get a job, you need to go to treatment, you need to go to domestic violence. And we load people up with about 90 to 100 hours worth of stuff to do, not taking into account the severe level of cognitive impairments and memory impairments that these folks have. As time goes on, we're probably going to learn more about this, and we're going to learn better ways to assist and help these folks into recovery. And we've learned quite a bit from researchers, researchers like Dennis, about how to help these folks get into recovery. And it's important that we do that because it saves a ton of money. I anticipate all of you have that little green handout in front of you on treatment effectiveness. And if you open to the very first page, you'll see some statistics there in regards to moms getting into recovery. Research here in Oregon shows that about 49.3% of moms get into recovery via treatment services and regain custody of their children once those kids have been removed. Now, some people might say 49.3%, that doesn't sound very good. That's massive. That's massive, because reuniting kids with moms in recovery saves the state a fortune in foster care services, other child welfare services, potentially future kids coming into foster care, reduces public assistance, and research that has not even been calculated in regards to cost-benefit analyses. Research here in Oregon through the Oregon Department of Correction showed that kids of incarcerated moms are 5 times more likely to end up incarcerated themselves in the future than their peers in the general population. The amount of money that this saves in the long haul is dramatic, and 49.3% is a lot, almost half. I was at one conference over in Seaside speaking to a group of district attorneys, and they were plotting ways to terminate parental rights. And I said, that's fine. You know, in cases where parental rights need to be terminated, you know, that's something that unfortunately we have to do. But we still need to work as hard as we can to get those moms in recovery. And one DA stood up in the training and he said, I don't understand. You know, once I terminate parental rights, I don't care. She can go off and kill herself on meth for all I care. And I said, well, see, the problem with that idea is that, see, that mom could end up having another kid and it's going to be back in the system again a couple years later. So by getting that mom into recovery, even if you've terminated parental rights, you're going to prevent future child welfare cases and future termination cases. So we need to do everything we can, and it makes good economic sense. Last thing I want to say is that people do get better, and research suggests that it takes about a year for brain chemistry to return to some semblance of normal. This was one young man. This was a glucose metabolism scan looking at brain activity levels, and this was over in Hawaii. And they scanned his brain. He was a methamphetamine addict, and they scanned his brain at 4 months clean and sober. He had many areas of the brain with low metabolic activity. It takes time for brain chemistry to return to normal after a person quits drinking and using. This was one guy admitted to the Almond Clinic down in California with years of alcohol, cocaine, and methamphetamine use. And here he is at 1 year clean and sober. People do recover, and they do get better, but we have to give them every opportunity to recover and help them as much as we can. And it's cheaper in the long run. Thank you.
Thank you very much for your compelling testimony. Any questions of this witness?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you for the testimony. Very helpful. You mentioned there was a slide about we're close to bottom of the nation in terms of treatment access for 18 to 25-year-olds. Could you talk a little bit more about that? I know that's also one of our highest uninsured rates in the state. Is that primarily the reason, just basically uninsured, lack of access that way? Is there something else going on?
I would say that it's the uninsured, and due to lack of infrastructure that's able to help people in regards to cash pay services. Some folks go into treatment and they pay cash for services, but more treatment centers that are larger, that have a broader infrastructure, are able to apply for other grants and national grants outside of Oregon. They're also able to scholarship more people. So there's infrastructure plus lack of insurance, both.
Thank you.
The information that you gave us here is very interesting, but you had some slides that gave figures that I think are not in here. It would be really helpful if you could give us a copy of your slides, if you could give that through the staff. That would be terrific.
Okay.
Thank you so much. Any other questions of this witness? Thank you very much for coming to testify. So now we have Anthony
Bigland. Good morning. My name is Anthony Bigland. I'm a senior scientist at Oregon Research Institute and the director of the Center on Early Adolescence. I'm also the president of the Society for Prevention Research, which over the last 15 years has been a coming together of all the people working on prevention. The common story among prevention scientists is the story of the cliff where people keep falling off, and we get better and better at having the emergency vehicles get there quickly and provide the services needed to the people who've fallen off the cliff. And prevention is about maybe putting a fence at the top of the cliff. Can we prevent people from getting involved in these problems to begin with? I'm going to talk a little bit about what the problems are and their cost. And I'm then going to try and give you a brief overview of the wealth of interventions that are available to prevent the kinds of problems that we've been hearing about this morning. And I'm going to try and provide you with some information about the cost benefit of those preventive interventions. These are some of the most common and costly problems of young people: antisocial behavior, smoking, alcohol use and abuse, and so on. The important thing to understand about these problems is that they are highly interrelated. We, in fact, did a study when I was at the Center for Advanced Study in the Behavioral Sciences in 2000, put together a book documenting the enormous amount of evidence that these problems are interrelated. This just gives you an example. If you look at the second column, the percent reporting the behavior, this indicates that 11% of the adolescents surveyed indicated that they used tobacco regularly. 85% of those 11% reported at least one other problem behavior. So here are the percents of people engaging in these behaviors, and here are the percents of those kids who are involved in some other problem. There are very few kids who have just one problem. I could say a lot more about that, but I'll send you my book. One of the things that we did in that analysis was look at the costs of these problems. We had a health economist look at the cost of kids with multiple problems, and these are just some of the problems that result in 1 year from these kinds of problems occurring. The total cost, we estimated, at about $419 billion a year that our society in the United States incurs as a result of youth with multiple problems. For Oregon, if you simply prorate that on the size of our population, that's about $5 billion per year costs we incur. Now, the primary influences on child and adolescent development are families, peer groups, schools, neighborhoods, and communities. Our Center on Early Adolescence has tried to pull together, based on the science, principles for ensuring successful development. If peers and families and schools and communities can provide these kinds of things, these kinds of conditions, we can make it much more likely that kids will develop successfully. We need to structure and guide. We need to model and teach. We need to support and encourage positive behavior with praise, reward, reinforcement. We need to have people, not just parents, connected and involved with young people, monitoring and supervising what they do, providing warm and nurturing interactions, listening to them and accepting them. This is a chart that is in our book. Basically, what this shows is that all along development, from the prenatal period right on up to adolescence, there are interventions targeting families, peers, schools, media, and community that are effective in reducing problems in adolescence. We only put things in this chart that have been shown to have an impact in reducing multiple problems in adolescence. So I'm going to give you a flavor of some of these. And we only included research where the intervention was evaluated in a randomized control trial, which is the gold standard for evaluating an intervention. One of them is David Olds' nurse visitation program. He has nurses visiting at-risk pregnant moms, particularly focused on poor teenage moms, starts visiting during pregnancy and works with them for 2 years through infancy. They focus on prenatal care, heavy emphasis on maternal smoking, which is extremely costly in terms of its impact on subsequent problems for kids. helping them with mothering, contraception, and work life. I won't go into great detail, but let me just show you what the RAND Corporation concluded about the value of this program for each of the parents who received it. These are the savings to government, improvements in the mother's income, and reduction in crime loss. They followed, in the first study that David Olds did, they followed parents for 15 years and found that there was reduced adolescent crime of the children whose parents got this program. So that's a tremendous cost saving, as you can see. So now I'm going to go through development. So now we go to elementary school. Here's the good behavior game. This is a simple thing where classroom teams in elementary schools earn small rewards for being on task and cooperative. There are more than 50 studies that have shown the value of this game. Here's one of them my friend Dennis Embry has provided. This shows the number of problems that kids who didn't get the good behavior game had versus the kids who did get it. So they have a smaller number of problems. And if you look over here, here are teachers' ratings of conduct problems. And the kids with high conduct problems at the beginning did significantly better right here by second grade than here. Shep Kellum, a psychiatrist at Johns Hopkins, showed that when he did this in first grade, they had significantly lower levels of arrest in middle school of the kids who got this, even when it was only done in first grade. This is a result from a recent study of the good behavior game showing that the kids who got the good behavior game had significantly less marijuana use in eighth grade than kids who didn't. These are the kids who didn't. I know I'm going fast, but I hope I'm being clear, and I've printed these out. And, of course, if you ask me, I'll tell you anything you want to know. When we get to middle school, risks for problems go up. There's a reduction in academic performance. There's lowered self-esteem. There's increased rates of depression. This is when deviant peer groups tend to form, and this is when substance use and delinquency really get started. One of the reasons is because teenage brains are different from brains of children or brains of adults, and I think that we've got some sense of that. Let me just show you two things. This shows the brain reward centers for young adults versus adolescents. And basically what this shows is that there are fewer reward signals to the brain, meaning that the intensity of rewards has to be higher for early adolescents to feel rewarded. We've got to shower them with positives for the positive behavior that we're trying to support and develop. Another aspect of adolescent brain development is that there's a decreased level of serotonin as kids go from 12 years old to 17 years old. And what you see as a result, if you've ever had a teenager, and I've had two.
The parents on this panel understand firmly.
I mean, we actually went to counseling with one son, and they said, no, his frontal lobes will come in, and it will change. And it did, I'm happy to say. One of the things that we've been developing in Oregon, and this is something, and many of these things, it's amazing how much research has been done in Oregon on these things. School-wide positive behavior support, there's a national movement, there are thousands of schools doing it, and it was developed here in Oregon. It provides active teaching of appropriate social behavior, praise and reward of appropriate social behavior, reductions in harassment. Here's what happened in one school, middle school that we worked in, when we introduced the positive behavior support program. These are office discipline referrals, which is a pretty good measure of how much disruption is going on. During the first year, there were a whole lot more. Seventh grade discipline referrals went down after we introduced positive behavior support. We're currently doing a study evaluating this in middle schools, in 36 middle schools in Oregon. Behavioral parenting skills. It's already been mentioned that parenting skills are very important. There are probably about 100 studies, randomized control trials, showing the benefits of parenting interventions in reducing early childhood oppositional problems, middle childhood antisocial behavior, adolescent delinquency, and adolescent substance use. One of them, done in Oregon by Tom DeShawn, Kate Cavanaugh, and Beth Stormshack, developed a family checkup, a family resource room, and parents could come in. They were invited to come in, and they could just get a checkup, a very brief look at their parenting practices and some feedback to the parents in a very supportive way. And here's what they found. And this was set up so that they could go into deeper things if they needed to. This is what they found with respect to marijuana use This is a program that they got in 6th, 7th, and 8th grade. By 11th grade, here are the kids who were at risk. These are the folks who weren't at risk. So I'm just going to talk about these two, this one and the one up here. The families of kids who were at risk who got this program had significantly less marijuana use than did the families of the kids who, the adolescents who didn't get the program. Here's adolescent arrest rate by age 18. As you can see, significantly lower arrest rates as a result of this very brief program. I'm not sure if I have time to describe this. This is the Strengthening Families program. Let me just take you to the bottom line. I hope this is reasonably clear. This is a graph that shows the cost savings for a dollar expended. This is an investment in prevention. And what they found is that with a dollar invested under the study conditions as they did it, they prevented enough alcohol and drug use to get a $9.60 return on that dollar investment. I can go into greater detail on this. Dick Spoth did this study in Iowa, and he'll kill me for the fact that I only used one of his slides, but onward. This is a study done by the Washington Public Policy Institute, which is the Washington State Public Policy Institute, which is created by was created by the state of Washington to study these things. Here are three programs, and this is the benefits per participant in reduced crime costs and criminal justice costs. Three family interventions, multidimensional treatment, foster care, per participant, a $77,000 reduction in criminal justice costs and other costs, functional family therapy, multisystemic therapy. Guess what, Oregonians? The best of those programs, multidimensional treatment foster care, was developed here by Patty Chamberlain and John Reed at the Oregon Social Learning Center, and it's being implemented nationwide.
Tell us briefly what that is.
Multidimensional treatment foster care. They take kids who are adjudicated, and they'll put them in a foster home with foster parents who are very closely trained, have a tremendous backup 24/7. They do skills training of the kids. They use the behavioral parenting kinds of interventions that all the other programs have used, and they produce significantly lower recidivism rates and, you know, with these kinds of cost-benefit. And I can provide you with much
Could
more
you do
information.
That? Could you do that for the whole...
Yes, happy to.
Great.
As the president of SPR, I'm sort of the representative, I think, of all of these people. So anything you need of
SPR
that sort.
SPR is
Society for Prevention Research.
Thank you.
Smoking is the number one preventable cause of disease and death, killing 450,000 people a year. There are school-based substance abuse prevention programs that have been shown to significantly reduce tobacco, alcohol, and other drug use. Here's an example of a study we did here in Oregon in 40 middle schools. This shows that the kids who had in sixth grade had a positive image of smokers are significantly more likely to take up smoking. They think smokers are cool. They're more likely to smoke. But with our program, which simply gave family communications about tobacco and youth anti-tobacco activities, we cut the rate of kids in the highest with the most positive image of sixth graders in half. In other words, half as many began smoking in the intervention and the control condition. There's a meta-analysis of media campaigns that shows that media campaigns can have a significant effect in reducing alcohol and tobacco use. There are community interventions, including one we did here in Oregon, Project 16, where we had 16 small Oregon communities involved. All of these studies that I list here have been randomized control trials showing that they have a significant impact on tobacco, alcohol, and other drug use. The Tobacco Prevention and Education Program in the state of Oregon, and by the way, I should mention that smoking is one of the early substance behaviors that has been shown to contribute to the development of all the others, so stopping smoking may be valuable in preventing these other problems. But here's what happened with Schools that were funded by the Tobacco Prevention and Education Program in Oregon, the 11th graders had less than 15% smoking versus 20% who were smoking in the schools that didn't get funded by TPEP. So if TPEP were fully implemented for the next 18 years, if it continued to provide just the benefit I described, it would save about 12,600 lives from people who didn't smoke. About a third of kids who start smoking eventually die of a smoking-related illness. The tobacco marketing expenditures in Oregon, I was an expert witness in the Justice Department lawsuit against the tobacco company, so I studied all these things. This is the amount of money spent on tobacco marketing in Oregon and versus the amount of money spent on tobacco control funding. One of the things I want to mention, you don't have necessarily, it's not simply through programs directed at individuals that you can have an effect. Policies can have an effect. This is a recent study by Kaplan et al. That concluded that a tobacco excise tax may be among the few policy options that will enhance a population's health status while making revenues available to government. This is a graph, which I apologize for the quality of this, but this shows how many lives would be saved in California if a 50 cent, these three, or a dollar tax on cigarettes were added to the tax on cigarettes. This shows that a dollar tax, and these are different, these are three different assumptions about how much that tax would have, but just the smallest impact that tax would have would save about 10,000 lives. It would save a little less than 10,000 lives in the first year of that tax. And by 75 years, it would be saving about 10,000 lives, and about 20,000 people, the quality of life would be improved in the sense that they weren't suffering from chronic illnesses. The same thing has been shown repeatedly with the effects of taxes on alcohol. Increasing the price of beer has been shown to decrease drinking among minors, to decrease binge drinking, to have a greater impact on heavy drinking teens than on other teens. That surprised me, but they've found that repeatedly. Heavy drinking teens are more affected by increasing the price of beer. And in addition, it's been shown that there's a decrease in motor vehicle fatalities among teens when you increase the price of beer. So Oregon can foster the successful development of young people if we require that evidence-based treatment and prevention programs be used whenever they're available. We increase the collaboration between the behavioral sciences and policymakers and practitioners. And Representative Greenlick has introduced a bill, as I understand it, that would create a task force to work on how behavioral sciences could work more effectively with policymakers and practitioners. We have one of the largest behavioral science industries, if you want to call it that, in the country, in Oregon, and we don't use those resources. We're known all over the world for the work we do, but it hasn't been used in Oregon nearly to the extent that it could be. And I think the third thing is we need to make successful youth development a fundamental value, that in every community, young people arrive at adulthood with the skills, interests, assets, and health habits needed to live healthy, happy, and productive lives and caring relationships with other people. I've tried to make the case for this as a hard-headed business proposition. There is money to be saved as well as lives to be saved if we do this. But I think that the other thing that we have to do is we have to say we want this state to be a state that's not at the bottom of the heap in terms of what we provide, but at the top, because we want every child to be successful. And we now have the science to make that possible. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Very compelling testimony. Representative Gelser.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you for a very interesting presentation. I was wondering if you had access to any information or studies that showed if there is any connection between youth substance abuse and untreated childhood mental illness.
Oh, yes. Depression is associated with substance use, in part because substance use is a way of trying to cope with depression. It's highly related. So if you have a kid who's depressed, treating them is probably going to prevent substance use mm-hmm. as well as benefit them in terms of their depression.
Follow up. In the previous presentation, we saw a little bit about how Oregon stacked up to other states in terms of youth treatment, and I'm wondering specifically how Oregon rates in terms of that association between untreated childhood and youth mental illness and substance abuse. Is that type of information available to see how we're doing compared to other states?
We have the Oregon Healthy Teens Survey as a representative sample of 8th and 11th graders, and we've been doing that now since 2000. And we have data on both depression and other problems. We don't have as much information in that as to how many kids are being treated. Our center is involved in a process right now where we're working on this problem of how you get coordination of family services and school services, because there's not good coordination. And so we've been doing focus groups with people working on this just to try and get our hands around the problem. And what they're telling us is that a huge problem is that there are kids who just don't have any money for services. So the ideal intervention would be to bring the family in and involve them, but they can't because kids don't have funding, but also because many of the private insurers won't pay for those kinds of services, despite the fact that they're the treatments of choice.
Thank you.
Representative Kotek.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you for your testimony. Is there anywhere where we could find out how many counties are actually using evidence-based and funding evidence-based programs to reduce the early onset of substance abuse?
In Oregon,
because I know you've talked a lot, and I know some of these programs are here, and some of them are not.
Yes,
and at what extent they are. And
I actually have a list of about 10 different programs that were developed in Oregon. To my knowledge, we don't have good data, but the answer is much less than it could be. Whether you're talking about family interventions or school-based interventions or media or whatever. One of the things that Representative Greenlich's bill might do would be to have this task force do an inventory of the extent to which that we're using evidence-based programs. Senate Bill 267 has the state moving in that direction, and so we're making progress on it. And it's really nobody's fault. Most of these are, the evidence is pretty recent. But now it's accumulated, and so now the scientists are going, ooh, we have to figure out how we can get these things out there. So,
follow up.
Thank you. Would that be something that the Commission on Children and Families should have in terms of their local planning process? Are the local plans related to that population?
Yes, I think that's one of the areas of where there needs to be better coordination. It's a strange situation in Oregon. We have all this money flowing from the National Institutes of Health, largely, paying for this kind of research, but it's never been dependent on cooperation with the state, and so all this stuff has been going on, but we haven't been building the kind of infrastructure that was talked about. Now we're starting to do that because the scientists are going, that's the next step, is how do you actually get this out there in communities and make it work in communities? And that's really what I'm most interested in trying to do.
So do you see as part of the next step then Representative Greenlich's bill to create a task force to look how to coordinate all of these programs?
Yeah, the concept would be to put together scientists, policymakers, practitioners, and figure out what are the high priority things that could be done to better integrate this. For example, we're now doing two randomized trials, one evaluating an alcohol access reduction, the other evaluating a tobacco prevention program. And we're doing that, thanks to the Oregon Healthy Teens data, we're doing that in 54 communities in Oregon. And we've randomized 18 of them to get the tobacco prevention, 18 to get the access reduction, and 18 are our controls. And we're doing this in cooperation with the TPEP program and with the addiction and mental health division. So we're beginning to get that kind of cooperation. And the hope is that if these programs prove to be useful, we can roll them out in a way that, we're much better positioned to roll them out than we otherwise would have been.
And have you made this type of presentation to the educational community? You talk a lot about what needs to happen in the classroom.
Yes. I'm working with members of our center, include Jeff Sprague and Rob Horner at the College of Education, and they're heavily involved in working with schools, as is the Child and Family Center at the University of Oregon, trying to get these family resource programs in the schools. But there's an awful lot of work left to be done to show how these can be used and to train people in using them and to have the resources. I mean, there aren't the resources that we really should have to do these things.
Right. Thank you very much. Representative Maurer.
Madam Chair, were you involved, you talked about TPEP a lot, were you involved with developing the control plan for 05 to...
The what?
The Tobacco Prevention Education Control Plan for the state of Oregon?
Not in any formal way. I've been interacting with them. We got a grant from the National Cancer Institute in 2000 to study tobacco prevention in schools, and the data I showed you came from that study. So it was thanks to that that we were able to, in fact, show that schools that had funding had lower levels of smoking.
Okay, thank you.
Any further questions?
Madam Chair, I want to refer to your slideshow. I appreciate you sharing that. The one slide at the toward the tail end that you have similarly increases the price of beer have been shown too. How many other states are doing this and showing that kind of research?
I worked with Harold Holder, who's one of the world's experts on this, in writing and in reviewing that evidence. I don't know exactly how many states. I understand that Oregon has a very low level of taxation, but there are numerous studies. There's no doubt among people like Alex Wagner and Harold Holder, who do this kind of research, that increasing the price of beer specifically will have the kind of benefits I described. But I don't know to what extent states have been increasing their tax on alcohol.
Maybe you can kind of follow where I'm going with this, and I understand what you're saying with your research and everything. I'm thinking that one of the best measurements for this to determine that is exactly if you have states that have gone ahead and done this and then observed, you know, through their Department of Transportation, that type of thing, all the other evidences that would support where you're wanting to go with this, for the crashes,
yes,
you know, human services, Alex, all those kind of things.
Alex Wagner, who is at the University of Florida, has data on alcohol-related car crashes and fatalities in every state. The research that I'm referring to there includes exactly those comparisons. Mm-hmm. Comparisons showing that in states with higher price of beer, and the most valuable studies are when they change the price of beer and they see a decline in alcohol-related fatalities.
And if you could get that research, that would be very helpful. If you could get it to our staff,
yes,
person, and he can distribute it to the
members. I'd be happy to.
Members. Mm-hmm. Thank you so much. Any further questions?
That's it. Thank you.
Yes, Representative Gilliam.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I believe that Marion County and surrounding counties for a long time have absorbed a disproportionate amount of the difficulty surrounding these issues. So I just have to make a quick comment, although I am sorry I missed Commissioner Carlson's testimony. I'm very proud of our sheriff and of the commissioner for getting a hold of some of these ideas, and I'm very grateful to you for your all of you for your testimony. I have a first question: is can you give us just a quick thumbnail of the relationship to the state of the Oregon Research Institute? Because I'm not sure of the funding and the relationship.
Oregon Research Institute was founded around 1960 by psychologists at the University of Oregon, but it's a private nonprofit organization. It gets virtually all of its funding from the National Institutes of Health, doing research on health-related issues, a lot of stuff on adolescents.
Thank you. Can I have a follow-up?
Follow-up.
As a freshman legislator, I have been getting quite a schooling on how we pay for these things, and it's been enlightening to me to see the advantages, particularly in the area of cigarettes, of so-called sin taxes. I'm wondering, from your position, can you also comment on your view on how we are funding, certainly from the general fund, in terms of priorities for the programs you're talking about?
I'm not sure how to answer that question. I don't know much about the funding mechanisms, not being a freshman legislator or any kind of legislator. I do know that I've shown you some, but not all, of the interventions, treatment as well. And I haven't done much with treatment, but the Patty Chamberlain's program, the foster family care, is really a treatment program. There's certainly a lot of benefit. Part of the problem, though, is that if a county mental health facility gets more money to do that, they're not going to realize the benefit. The people whose houses weren't broken into are going to realize the benefit. The criminal justice system that doesn't have to incarcerate people is going to realize the benefit. So, you know, it's we kind of have to all come together here to really think about the benefits of it.
Thank you.
Any further questions? Thank you so much. Your testimony was very enlightening. Thank you for coming to Salem. Janet, and what do we have? Our commissioners. Are there other speakers that you've invited?
No.
It's good to be last.
That's it? All right. Thank you. Yes, and that's great. Wonderful questions from our committee. And thank you so much for the presentation. For all the people who've come here today, thank you so much. This is an issue that this committee will be dealing with further.
Yes.
Madam Chair, thank you. Commissioners Janet Carlson and Lisa Nato, I do greatly appreciate your work on what you've done with Senate Bill 267. And thanks for this, too.
Thank you very much. Thanks for all who came to today, especially our speakers. I will close the... yes?
I was just wondering if there were others who hadn't been invited that wanted to testify.
We didn't open this one up to anything except invited testimony. Okay. Thank you. We'll close the public information hearing on mental health, and we will open up a public hearing on House Bill 2181. Andy.
Thank you, Chair Tomei. House Bill 2181 is a measure that would require protected supervision of a ward of the state. A child has been reunited with a parent after an out-of-home placement. It would limit commitment of the ward for a period. The ward, in this case, would be DHS for a period of 90 days after reunification or another period specified by the court.
Great. And we have Kevin George from the Department of Human Services.
Chair Tomei, members of the committee, my name is Kevin George, and I work as the foster care program manager at the Department of Human Services in the Child Welfare Division. And I would, two comments. One is I would very much appreciate you taking actually the time today listening to all the stuff about the drug and alcohol, and I would just say welcome to our world, because oftentimes we're on the recipient end of these children who come into foster care as a result of all this information. So this is very enlightening, and I jotted many mental notes that I will be following up on as far as some of the evidence base. What I provided you today is a written testimony, and I will be brief on that, as well as I provided a copy of some amendments that we've asked for Legislative Council to get in for an amendment to the bill on House Bill 2181. And so I want to speak to actually those amendments today. Put this in some context, the Department of Human Services, as a result of the Governor's Office, had National Resource Center for Child Protective Services come into our state 2 years ago during the last legislative session and reviewed a number of our practices and our policies around how we were operating in the state around keeping children safe. And as a result of that, provided a number of recommendations for us in order to improve our practice and our system. This is one of those such recommendations we're bringing forward now in terms of trying to clarify the legal custody of children when they are with the department, and when they are in foster care, legal custody is with us, and when the children are returned home, so reunited with their families, the legal custody will continue with the department. And we're asking at this point in time that we get some clarification on exactly roles and responsibilities. So what you will find in the current system is that children are found in the legal jurisdiction of the juvenile court, and they are temporarily committed to the Department of Human Services. Once these children then return home, the court continues the custody of the child, And currently in statute, there's no limitation on how long that custody action may maintain. So the court has the ability through judicial discretion to say, I want the department to continue to supervise this family for 30 days. I want the department to continue for 6 months, or I ask that we come back in 6 months and review the family and how we're doing at this point in time. So what we're asking at this juncture is to really asking the court to clarify the role and responsibility of the department and put in a minimum of a 90-day post-placement supervision. At the end of the 90 days, then, the custody would actually terminate from the department, and the court maintains the ability to extend that, to review that, to add other conditions for it, but they would need to make actually findings as to why they would need to continue that care. Part of this goes into practice stance of really empowering families, getting families to understand they're now receiving custody of their children back, and they have the legal authority to be doing all the things such as signing for school and medical care and whatnot. And at some point in time, trying to get the family to understand they are back in charge of their family and their role and having their child with them. So with this bill, it would we've had conversations with Juvenile Rights Project and with the Oregon Judiciary, and what they're asking as far as the Oregon Judiciary is asking is that we provide, instead of having an automatic 90-day termination, is that we send a letter back to the court informing them that the 90 days is getting ready to expire. And if any party to that case then has an issue with that, they have the right and the responsibility to ask for a court hearing to review any of those conditions. And so one of those things that we've talked about with the juvenile court is that we could put that in our administrative rules. Currently, there's nothing in statute that says how to close a judicial case. And so we would actually be able to put in our administrative rules that before a department caseworker notifies the court that the termination is going to happen, we could identify the three or four conditions that they need to make sure they've addressed, and then before asking the court for it to be dismissed. So in essence, a long rambling way, I've gone through that. It's much more succinct in my testimony than I'm providing you right now. But it's important to remember how big of a population we're talking about. 64% of our kids actually are reunited with families every year, and that accounts for over 3,500 children that come into foster care and that are going back home. So we're really talking about this bill addressing about 3,500 children and trying to clarify why the department is involved with this family and for what time period it needs to happen before we close the case. I'd be happy to answer any questions you might have regarding House Bill 2181.
Thank you, Mr. George. Any questions? Yes,
Representative Gilson. Thank you. Of that 64% that returned to the custody of their parents, what percentage are then removed from their families again?
Chair Tomei, Representative Gelser, I can provide that to you. I don't have it right this minute with me. We do have a reentry rate. I believe it's somewhere around 8%. Federal benchmark, I believe, is 8.6%, mm-hmm. and we actually are below. So we're actually doing better than what this federal benchmark is. But it's right around 8%. To give you an accurate number, I'll have to actually respond back to you in writing.
And can I follow up on that question before my next question? That 8% or whatever the percentage is that just children that then are removed from custody of their parents or children that again come to the attention of the agency receiving some sort of service, even if the parents continue to retain custody of the parents, where DHS comes in, they're providing services and supervision later because of further concerns about the child's safety or welfare?
Chair Tomei, Representative Gelser. The standard that I'm providing as far as the national benchmark standard is of all those children who are reunified within 12 months, do they come back into foster care? So do they physically come back into mm-hmm. foster care? And of those children then, what is the rate? And so at this point in time, we have, again, an 8% of those children who are reunified actually come back into foster care within 12 months.
And it would be helpful to have that number, and then also if the information is available to see what that recurrence rate of the need for services and becoming involved with the agency is for kids that are reunified with their parents. And then my second question was, in the request from the bench that notification be given rather than the involvement just being ended and people being notified, would court-appointed special advocates be part of that group that would be notified that 90-day period was over so that child's CASA would have the opportunity to have input into how successful that transition back home had been?
Yes, Tomei, Representative Gelser, every party to the case of which children that actually have a court-appointed service advocate, they'd be a party to the case. They would also be notified. So the parent's attorney, mom's attorney, dad's attorney, the attorney for the child, the CASA, and the court would all be notified. Any other legal parties to that case would be as well.
Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Hi, Mr. George. Thank you for your testimony. I just want to follow up to comment what Representative Gelser was saying, that 8% of children who go back into the system, we're doing better than the national average, and we're actually doing very well, is the testimony you gave the other day in Ways and Means. So that's a positive. I guess I'm not crystal clear the purpose of this change and why we need it. So if you could elaborate a little bit more. I mean, anyway. It's just I don't understand where the report was going. You make reference to the Holder report. Could you elaborate on why we need this?
Certainly. Chair Tomei, Representative Kotek, thank you. And I'm just trying to look at time. I was speeding fast through.
That's
this.
Okay.
part of what the challenge is that in many, many states around this country, legal custody of a child is only in place when the state actually physically has that child in a foster care home or in your physical care. In many states, once a child physically returns back to the parents, the legal custody is terminated at that point in time. Some states have a limit of 90 days, some have 6 months, some, like Oregon, have no limit. And so part of when the national reviewers were in here, what they were looking at was, we have many kids in the state's legal custody that are not physically in our custody. They're with parents, both before they come into foster care and after they go home. And so part of what the clarification from the National Resource Center was that the Department of Human Services really needs to focus in on what it is that you're actually providing. Having legal custody of a child for 6 months, yet you're not providing any services, you have this illusion of safety, and that what is really happening for that child out there, legal custody is not what's making this child safe or not. What's making this child safe or not is the constant attention by the department with the family to make sure things are getting better, face-to-face contact, and you're really ensuring that family is taking the responsibility, as we learned here, around being parents again. So what this bill really is trying to do is, instead of having cases where we actually have legal custody of children for 6 months, 12 months, or beyond after they've gone home, is to say, let's put an identified time, 90 days after they've gone back home, let's put the protective supervision, post-placement supervision in at that point in time, and if the court deems necessary to continue it, fine, the court can order another 90 days or 6 months, but they would need to make findings as to why the state is going to continue to be involved with the family. Right now, there is no findings of facts why the state has to stay involved, and so custody can continue on for months at a time. And so it's really trying to clarify for us, what is our role, why are we intervening with that family at this point in time?
Follow up. Thank you. That's helpful. I would assume historically there was a reason it was open-ended. Was there? Or?
Chair Tomei, Representative Kotek, I really don't have that historical knowledge. I certainly know that there's just no finite time at this point. The only finite amount of time that's actually currently in the statute is when the child reaches 21. So that's the only really finite amount of time. I can only speculate because I don't know how this was crafted or if it was 20 years ago or 30 years ago. Judicial discretion oftentimes is what drives much of the practice around child welfare, and this bill continues to allow that judicial discretion. What it does is it just puts in a requirement to be clear as to why we're going to continue the custody. So I don't know historically why it's there, but judicial discretion in child welfare is really what drives most of the statutes at this point.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I guess my concern is there's probably it sounds like there's a concern that once a child goes back into the home, they're really not getting too many services from the state, so why keep them in whatever the term is, legal custody? But that, I would assume, is more of a resource issue than I would assume we would still want to have contact with that child when the child goes back to the home, and the reason it's not happening now is more of a resource issue than a policy practice. I'm just wondering if you think that's the case.
Chair Tomei, Representative Kotek, I think to some degree there might be a flavor to that, but quite honestly, it is about trying to identify why are we involved. I mean, certainly 100 years ago as a caseworker, and I had many conversations with families around, Mr. George, why do you keep coming out to my house? And it's because, well, the court still has legal custody, so I'm still legally responsible for your children, and yet they've been home for 6 months or 9 months, and until we can get back to court and have them close out the case, I've got to keep coming out here and keep involved in your life. And so part of it is that, to try to be very clear with families who deserve the respect and the responsibility on us, to be very clear, why is it you're still intervening with my family? Why is it you still have control over my child? Why is it that I technically can't sign legal documents for my child? And so part of it is to be very clear about why it is we're involved with the family, more so than a resource need. The resource need really comes from a standpoint of saying, if there are a finite amount of resources, we've got to be able to, just as the slides earlier said, be very clear and very deep in the services you provide families, more so than trying to spread across, trying to serve everybody and not serving anybody very well with the limited resources. So I think there's both a resource issue, but more importantly, I think the issue is about trying to strengthen families and get back to saying, let's be clear about when a state intervenes in a family's life, we need to know why and for how long we're going to be doing that.
As a former caseworker, I certainly relate to that, because you have dozens of people that might still be on your caseload who really don't need any more services, but you're sort of obliged to still keep these people in custody.
Okay, one quick.
Sure.
And thank you for your allowing me all the follow-up. I guess I'm just trying to understand current practice as well as I can, why we need this change. So in terms of legal custody staying, is that, I'm flipping to the court system now, it's because they haven't had a chance to get back to review the case for the child? Because in 90 days, unless the court jumps in, the state is disconnected from that child, or at least DHS is. And is it the court not keeping up with the review of why there still needs to be the connection with DHS? I'm just wondering what's going on.
Representative Tomei, Chair Tomei and Representative Kotek, it's actually a combination of all of the above. Every party to the case has the ability to ask for a court hearing at any point in time during the whole life of that case. Part of what ends up happening, I think, is that we've built a false sense of security in Oregon by keeping custody with the state, of being able to then say 6 months out, well, the state still has custody. Therefore, if I'm sitting in a courtroom, I can say, yes, I've got somebody out there looking at this family, watching over this family, and it is that false sense of security that's out there. Having a custody of a child open for no other reason than to say that somebody's out there looking at this child. You know, I think we've built a dynamic in our state where it is a false sense. We have, right now, when you talk about the current practice is that once a child goes back home, there may or may not be another court hearing set up 3 months, 6 months, a year from now. And it may be that all the parties to the case have all agreed, yes, it is time for this child to go back home. The child goes back home on Friday. And we then continue down the path for several months until the department then sends a letter to the court saying, may we be relieved of custody of this child because there are no other conditions, no other services we're providing. But it may be 6 months, 9 months down the road. So what we're asking at this point in time is to say, let's put some ownership on all the parties of this case to come back either into court in 90 days and decide why it is we need to continue, or all acknowledge, yes, it is time for all of us to go on to our next cases. It's just really trying to put an accountability on every party to the case about why we're going to be involved.
Thank you for your...
That's good.
It would be helpful to us if we could get a copy of the National Resource Center recommendation that we do this, that we change this.
Certainly, Chair Tomei, we'd be happy to provide the National Resource Center. What I can also do is provide you at least a draft, because it's Representative Kotek already referred to it, that I provided to the Ways and Means last week on the reunification and reentry into foster care percentages and how we compare to other states in the area.
Great. Thank you so much. Any further questions? Yes, Representative Collins.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you for coming. I just have a sort of the other side of the picture question that's running through my mind is making these changes, or perhaps in comparison to current practice, is there any possibility that the department is perhaps more willing to reunite children with their natural parents because there's that sort of safety net of, well, we still retain custody for this period of time? meaning if that were shortened, would there be some reticence to move forward with that reunification? If you see where I'm going with that thought process, it was just sort of running around in my head. I'd appreciate your comments on it.
Chair Tomei, Representative Cowan, interesting perspective. I don't know what I would think about that at this point. I do know that one of the things that we are changing as far as the practice before we even get to the reunification, and again, we've been pretty steady the last few years around 64% of the kids, 63.5% and whatnot going home. One of the other practice changes that we are putting into place right now through new administrative rule and practice is identifying conditions for return. So trying to be very clear with the families up front and the court and other parties about what it's going to take for the child to actually get back home. And once we meet those and achieve those, then it's time for the child to go back home. So would it be factored in then to say, I may be more shy about sending the child home if I know I only have 90 days? We still have the ability, both as the DHS and any other part of the case, to tell the court, and we would like this to be at least a six-month post-supervision time period. We have that ability through this bill to be able to do that. And quite frankly, on some cases where a child may have been in foster care for 4 years while parents have been in recovery or other conditions change, and now we're looking at home, I quite frankly would be asking the court for a longer supervision period of time while we monitor that family because the child's been out of care for so long. But those situations where a child's been in care maybe 30 days and now they're back home, does the state really need to stay in care for 6 months, 9 months afterwards? So an interesting perspective. I'll have to chew on that one a little bit.
Follow up? Thank you. I appreciate that. And actually, that was helpful to me to understand that you would, maybe I didn't fully pick up that you would have the authority to extend it if you needed to. I mean, my goal, like the state's, is to reunite children with their parents if possible. But the top priority for me is the safety of those children. And so that's the reason I was toying with it. But I appreciate that clarification. Thank you.
Any further questions at this time? Thank you so much. And we have Amy Miller, is that right?
Good morning, Chair Tomei and members of the committee. I'll be brief as well. My name is Amy Miller. I'm a staff attorney at the Juvenile Rights Project. And just for background information, the Juvenile Rights Project represents and advocates for children and families in Oregon. More specifically, we represent several thousand children and youth involved in the child welfare and juvenile justice systems by court appointment each year in Multnomah County. I'm here today to talk to you about concerns in HB 2181. We have serious concerns regarding the effects of this bill, which dramatically alters established juvenile court practice. And specifically, this bill alters the role of DHS in child abuse and neglect cases in the period after a ward is left an out-of-home placement for reunification with a parent. Under this bill, agency involvement would end automatically 90 days after a ward is reunified with a parent. And as a result, children are placed at risk. It's entirely possible that DHS custody could terminate without the knowledge of the court, caseworker, attorney, and CASA involved in the case because they may not have received notice. JRP is concerned that HB 2181 could also slow down the reunification process and result in longer stays in foster care because courts may be more hesitant to reunify a ward with parents, knowing that agency involvement can terminate, possibly without court knowledge or approval. And in addition, older children may be particularly vulnerable under this bill because wardship can continue until age 21, but after age 18, a child cannot reenter the dependency system in the same way as a younger child. We believe that courts should decide what agency involvement ends in a dependency case, and that the agency should inform the court and the parties as to why services are no longer needed. We believe DHS has a duty to explain that services are not needed and ask the court to dismiss commitment. There is too much at stake for all of this oversight to end automatically after a particular number of days. We have been working with DHS regarding these concerns, and amendments are in the process of being drafted, which Mr. Jord referred to, which I believe will provide the additional notice to parties that agency involvement will terminate. However, I don't think these amendments will resolve the automatic termination issue as far as agency involvement. Aside from our concerns already discussed, This bill would require extensive retraining of DHS workers, judicial officers, court staff, attorneys, CASAs, and others involved in the child welfare system. We are also unclear on the scope of the problem this bill addresses and whether this bill does, in fact, address the problem at issue. Thank you for considering my comments and opposition and concerns to this bill, and I'll be happy to answer any additional questions you may have.
Thank you. Representative Gelson.
Thank you, Representative May. If I think about who the children that this bill might impact, kids that have been removed from their home, would I be correct in assuming that there has been some significant degree of trauma or breach of that child's safety or welfare in order for that child to be removed from the home in the first place?
Chair Tumay, Representative Gelser, that would be a correct assumption in order for the child to be removed, absolutely.
Great. Thank you.
Any further questions?
Madam Chair, I just have a question.
Yes, next.
Amy, in your written testimony here on the second page, you have GRP is also concerned that House Bill 2181 will slow down the reunification process. Do you have any evidence to support that?
I don't have any evidence to support that. What I'm talking about specifically is that a child could be returned home and the court could never see. Well, the child could be returned home, agency involvement could end, right? And the court may not be involved in the case before the agency involvement ends. So from the perspective of a judicial officer, I would imagine you would want to be very careful when returning a child home, as you already would be, but there's just that concern that perhaps agency involvement could end before the court was aware.
Thank you.
Representative Cowan.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you. I think that now I'm more confused than I was when I asked my question the last time. going back to the testimony from Mr. George, I'm looking at a time period of up to 90 days post-placement supervision by the department unless otherwise ordered by the court. And in your statement that the ward's case ends automatically in 90 days, but that kind of gets to the question I was asking and the information I had that could be extended if people feel that there is a reason for it. So do you not anticipate good communication between the court and the Department of Human Services in this process? Is that?
Chair Tomei, Representative Cowan, I don't think communication is the issue. The issue is current practice. The agency comes into court and says, we've done all these services. The family is doing well. We would like to have the case closed, and it is closed. This proposes that there wouldn't be that check. Rather, the DHS would not be involved any longer unless a party raises a concern. And so it's a kind of a shifting of the burden from one to the other, and that is the concern that we are trying to discuss.
Representative Gelson and Representative Maurer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. One of the concerns that's running around in my mind is the disconnect sometimes between the desire that everybody has to do the right thing for a child and the number of kids a caseworker might have on their caseload. And I'm wondering if you can speak to me a little bit about a concern that I'm having, that if the burden shifts to, unless someone steps up and says otherwise, we're ending involvement, my concern is that a kid that's kind of middling, there's some concern, but on a caseload where there's kids with much higher concerns, that some more of these kids are going to end up falling through the cracks unless there is that mandated explanation and involvement of the court to make that decision to end the involvement. Do you think, or does the Juvenile Rights Project believe that we are adequately staffing our child welfare programs to the degree that kids would be protected by having caseworkers that have enough time to thoroughly evaluate each child at the end of 90 days to determine without the intervention of a court whether or not this child that already has had a significant trauma is now safe to be without supervision at the court or DHS?
Chair Tomei, Representative Gelser, that's a great question. I can't speak to the agency staffing level. However, I know that we're in support of reducing caseloads so that caseworkers are able to spend more time working on cases and trying to bring those caseloads back in conformance with national standards.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Representative Maurer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. because I don't know the system very well, court times are, what's the lead time for getting the court date?
Chair Tomei, Representative Maurer, there's a couple of different ways it works. A court date can be set out a particular period, so after a hearing, if the plan were to return the child home, a court date could be set out, say, 90 days later or 6 months later. So there's one way. Another way is, though, to request an expedited review hearing, to request a hearing of the court, and the agency has this ability to do that as well as an attorney. And that can be done very, very quickly. So if a child were returned home and things were going very, very well and the agency no longer wanted to be involved, a request could be made for a review hearing. The hearing could occur, and then the court could go ahead and terminate commitment to the agency.
Okay. I hear a conflict in the two testimonies in that regard somewhat. And the other issue is, you said in your testimony, in addition, this bill will require extensive retraining, et cetera. And I don't see a training requirement per se in the bill. Is that correct? There's no. Is there a training requirement in the bill?
Chair, if I may, Representative Maurer. The bill doesn't specifically speak to training, but this is a big change in process. So because of that, everybody's going to have to be retrained to understand what this change is, how it impacts clients, and how it impacts cases. So there's going to be some additional training that's going to have to occur.
I guess I've never seen a follow-up. Thank you. I've never seen training or a training need stopping some requirement to better a process. So I guess I have a concern with that charge.
Representative Chair Tomei, Representative Maurer, I appreciate you pointing that out. And it was just to bring up a point that this is a big change in process. That was all. Thank you.
Representative Kotek.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Will we have a chance today to talk about the proposed amendments and how Juvenile Rights Project? Is this for a later date?
I didn't know. No, you've seen the amendments. Do you have any response to those?
Chair Tomei, Representative Kotek, this is the first set of amendments, and then we've discussed since then a second set of amendments. Am I correct on that? And so I could speak better to the second set of amendments, which is going to, it's my understanding, would include a notice. We discussed a notice provision so that everybody, other parties to the case, would receive notice that a child's been returned home and there's a 90-day window that's now going to start, or 90-day clock that's now going to start. However, that doesn't address or eliminate the concern that we have with the automatic termination of agency involvement.
And we'll see those amendments later. We're not going to be finished working on this today, colleagues. We'll be hearing this again. We'll see further amendments and have further discussion.
Thank you for the clarification that there's more coming. That's helpful. Thank you.
Representative Gilliam, we're going to make it short.
I will. Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a quick word about Juvenile Rights Project, please.
Chair Tomei, Representative Gilliam, as to what our...
Your mission, and just give me a little background, I'm sorry.
Oh, okay. We're a law firm that represents and advocates for children in Oregon, specifically, mostly by court appointment. We represent thousands, both in the dependency system, so children involved with DHS, as well as the delinquency system. And we actually do special education advocacy as well, and then a couple of folks work on bigger picture advocacy issues. We've been involved in the legislature since 1976, providing technical assistance, testimony on bills, and as well as have introduced with the assistance of the legislature bills along the way to improve the system.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Thank you for your involvement.
Thank you.
And concern. Thank you very much. Colleagues, I'm going to be closing a public hearing on House Bill 2181. And I have some committee bills. So, Andy, help me with these. I'm going to be asking you to vote on these committee bills. It does not mean that you support these, that you will vote on them, that you will support them in committee, and certainly not on the floor of the House. But since today is the last day we can drop bills, I'm proposing these. Yes, Representative Gelser.
I move that LC 3158 be introduced as a committee bill.
Representative Gelser moves that LC 3158 be introduced as a committee bill. Any discussion? Do we need an individual vote? We just say all in favor. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed? Thank you. LC 3158 is proposed as a committee bill. And I'll open up the hearing on LC 3159.
Madam Chair, I move that House Bill 3159 be introduced as a committee bill.
LC.
Representative Gelser moves that LC 3159 be introduced as a committee bill. Any discussion? All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? LC 3159 will be introduced as a committee bill. Any further discussion? A lot of our friends in the mental health community are meeting here today, so I would encourage all of us. We saw so many who were here today to listen to this testimony. We didn't have time to listen to further testimony, but I want you to feel free to go and talk to people from your areas and also to other people who are interested in mental health issues.
May I just say that I'm noticing the red shirts in the room. It's also school-based healthcare day in the Capitol, and you're going to see them running around the Capitol day, but given our conversation about reducing risky behavior among youth, school-based health center has been very helpful in reducing tobacco use, other substance abuse, mental health issues. So,
great.
And there are a lot of students from around the state, so John, a lot
welcome.
Of youth in the building today.
Thank you today. Thank you. Coming. Good to see you all. Any further questions, concerns? All right, I close the House Committee on Human Services and Women's Wellness.